Central Piling are proud to sponsor the Breaking Ground podcast. It aligns with our goals of providing technical expertise, continuous improvement, and community engagement. These are things we've been striving for since our inception over 40 years ago. Some of the engineering achievements during that time include the design and construction of the foundations for West London's tallest residential building, complex 3D finite element analysis to facilitate the creation of a triple-storey basement, and damage impact assessments for underground assets on a rotary-cased piling contract. Our plant includes a wide range of bored piling machine sizes. These are continually being updated to ensure emission regulation compliance and efficiency. We're also able to offer driven precast and steel piling on selected contracts. To learn more about what we do and discover details of how we might be able to help you on your next foundation or retaining wall scheme, visit centralpiling.com.
Hello, welcome to the Breaking Ground podcast. Today we're joined by Natalie Buse, who is the Managing Director at Skelair. Hi, Natalie.
Good morning. Hello.
And to chat with Natalie, I'm joined once again by Kieran Jennings, the Secretary of the EFFC, the FPS, the Ground Forum. What have I missed?
I think that probably just about covers it all. Yeah.
Okay, good stuff.
Good morning, everyone.
Lots of hats that you're wearing. So glad to finally get this recording together, Natalie. It feels like a while. I've been discussing, I think, maybe we're not so much awareness from your side, but trying to get in touch and pin you down. I'm just really excited about the things that we're going to learn about your career and your views on the industry. And so I think a really good place to start is your own beginning with the industry and you taking us on a bit of a journey about how you got to the position you are within the industry now.
Okay. Well, I had a love of geology right from when I was at school, and I was very fortunate. I went to a school where O-level geology was on the curriculum, so that's giving my age away for a start, because I didn't do GCSEs, did O-level. But, so I was very fortunate that I did an O-level in geology and then an A-level in geology at a mainstream school, and then went on to do a geology degree. I always knew that I wanted to work in the geotechnical sector. Getting a job after graduating was quite challenging, and it was more by luck that I got into the industry. I was working behind a bar in the village of Tickhill, and one of the other guys that was working there as well, Andrew Sloan, he said that, you know, his father was looking at getting him a job working on the drilling rigs, and I got his father's name, and he suggested that I applied for a job.
So this is post-graduation, and you didn't see sort of any options prior to graduation sort of falling in your lap, and maybe you'd not decided that your future was in ground engineering at that point, sort of before graduation.
So whilst I was still there, you know, you got to your third year of your degree course as an undergraduate, and there was options to go to Imperial to do an MSc, but I didn't want to. I wanted to go into industry. I wanted to leave academia. I wanted to get a job. You know, I wrote off. There was no internet, obviously, so you just had to write off and pray that somebody opened your letter and you were called for an interview. I wrote to all the offshore operators. I didn't know much about ground investigation on land. I didn't know much about it at all. And it was through this colleague that I worked with at the pub when he said his father was the drilling manager. And he was actually the drilling manager at Norwest Holst Soil Engineering, where I did eventually get a job. Before Andrew, by the way. So Andrew got a job, but much later.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? We could go on for a while about it, but sometimes undergraduates do find it difficult to identify opportunities. And and you kind of lucked in through your connection at the pub. And we've spoken a lot of times on the call about the mentoring scheme, but even sort of going beyond the mentoring scheme, just getting more businesses into universities to explain what you do and sort of the process of applying, what different businesses offer. You know, I think that probably has improved since you and I were at university, Natalie. But I think there's still a lot more work that industry could do to help themselves in terms of employment. But sorry, we'll come back to that, I'm sure, about education later in the call. Carry on with your career journey, please.
Thanks, Steve. I did eventually start at Norwest Hall Soil Engineering, and I started as an assistant geotechnical engineer in the lab. They had their own soil and rock testing laboratory, and I started in there doing the split and describes of U100s that had been tested in the triaxial room. So I was there around 6 months, and then I eventually managed to get into the main building and into the engineer's office just through sheer tenacity. Every Friday I went into the main engineer's office and said, can I be an engineer yet? A proper engineer, can I join the team? And eventually they said yes. So that was the real start of my journey as a geotechnical engineer. So I spent the next kind of 12 years working as a geotechnical engineer, starting at the bottom, doing logging, trial pitting, and then all the way up to project management towards the end of that part of my career, where I was running multi-million pound projects in the UK and Ireland. Majority being major road jobs, infrastructure projects, working as, you know, a site agent on site and then project manager in the office. And then I had a change of circumstances where I wanted to put some roots down, you know, buy a house, get a cat, all those things. And so I spoke to my MD at the time and I said, look, you know, I can't do this anymore, working away from home constantly on the road. And he said, you know, do you want to have a go at business development, helping a gentleman called Mike Newton, who was the business development manager at the time at Soil Engineering. So Norwest Holst got bought by the Vinci Group and changed its name to Soil Engineering, which is still Soil Engineering Geoservices today. So I started as business development to Mike Newton, and I learned such a lot from Mike about winning work, promoting the business, the company, chasing particular projects, having a project in your sights and then really chasing it down until you've got the opportunity to bid for it, and then putting in a winning bid. It's not just about the price, it's all about the supporting documentation, the methodology, how are you proposing to do the project, giving the clients assurances that you're the best person to do that project for, to deliver it.
And how did you feel about sort of getting involved with that? Because you said you did a geology degree, and I did civil engineering, but looking back, there wasn't really anything around sort of marketing, business development. And yet, for both of us, it's such a big part of our day-to-day jobs. And will be the same for a huge proportion of people that have gone through university degrees. So you do think there's a bit of a knowledge gap there that maybe courses should be picking up. What do you think, Kieran?
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I'd love to hear a bit more about that, Natalie, how that transition was for you, because, you know, going from somebody who's absolutely at the heart of delivery into something that is a sales role. Now, I have my own kind of thought on that I'll share, but I want to sort of hear how that transition was for you, and how was it an easy thing? Did you find it natural, or was it a complete sort of mindset shift for you?
I found it really easy, because part of being an engineer, a project manager, you have to write the proposal, the RAMs, the risk assessments, the method statements, the contract phase plan, how you're going to approach the works. And when you're tendering for a job, you also have to write a proposal. and a methodology of how you intend to deliver that job for the client. So that was just a natural progression, because I'd already been doing that for projects that were won and awarded. So this was writing exactly the same as if we'd won it, but in order to win it. So this is the approach, this is the methodology that we would apply if we won this job. So it was just doing it at tender stage. And I was working for Mike Newton, who was a brilliant mentor. And he'd also been a geotechnical engineer, and he'd progressed into business development. And it was applying everything that I'd learnt whilst on site, whilst being a project manager, and putting that into the proposal that helped us to win the work. We had estimators that just did the estimating, but we put together all the proposal, the supporting documentation. And really, you know, Mike was absolutely brilliant, because he said, you know, the way that you win a job, it's not the tender, it's getting the opportunity to tender. And that's where, you know, personal relationships and knowing people and going out and meeting people and speaking to them and just being enthusiastic about your whole industry. And you need to gauge where you think the projects are going to be, what sectors that are going to be spending money on ground investigations, what sectors are going to be developing, and doing your homework basically, and then literally getting into the ribs of those key decision makers who are going to be putting you on a tender list. And it's an award comes from the opportunity, not the tender.
Yeah, I mean, my sort of philosophy on this, or my sort of perception on this, is that the people who are best at that, the best sort of, if you like, salespeople, are people who don't even realize that they're salespeople. They're people who want to achieve something, build something, make something, and that's what's motivating them. It's not actually, you know, it's not actually driven by, you know, a sort of winning a commission or a financial motivation at all, really. It's actually more about the change in the world, and people who are aligned with that, I think, are what people buy when you're getting into the ribs of them, is my perception anyway. But
exactly that. Yeah, a salesperson is, you know, we're not selling double glazing or anything like that. We're not really selling anything. What we're doing is just trying to promote our companies or ourselves to be able to get the opportunity to tender. And it is sales, but it's not sales. It's just being yourself, being authentic. And,
you've gone through the looking glass there.
It's just weird.
You need to find a connection with people, don't you?
Yeah, I think
people skills are massively important, and maybe some engineers, you know, the ones that are more into the tech side, traditionally don't have such strong soft skills, shall we say? And that is something I feel can be learned and developed.
But also, you know, all the way through my career and when I was on site as well. And it's really important to convey to the staff, it doesn't matter who they are, whether they're drilling staff, ground workers, engineers, when they're on site, they're representing the company and they're ambassadors of the industry. And so they're also selling, if you like, they're selling the company and the services, whether it's ground investigation or piling or groundworks, whatever it is, and they're representing the whole industry. And it's important that everybody realises that a little part of what they do is actually sales and marketing every single day. When you put your face on, your PPE on, your hard hat, and it's got the logo on, you're representing that company.
Even driving to site, you know, you cut up the manager of your next client.
it's
probably not going to do you any favours, is it?
No, exactly that. And, you know, it's the same with if you're on the motorway, driving a liveried vehicle, a van, or, don't speed. Just be mindful that you're representing the company. And everybody knows, you know, it's we're in service delivery, whether you're in catering or any industry, it's service delivery. and want to deliver a good service and represent yourself well. So
you're always on stage, aren't you?
Always,
Is that, or just make all the vans white? No livery.
That's an alternative.
But also, you represent, when you're on site, you're also representing your customer, the end client. So you want to represent them well, because they'll repeat business is very important.
You need to turn your clients into advocates for you. Yeah, I mean, that's sort of 101 in the handbook of consultative sales for me. But I perceive in this industry, from where I sit, is that, again, it's an industry that's very sort of atomized on cost. And actually, you don't see a lot of consultative, or I don't, at least, don't see a lot of consultative selling happening from where I sit. But I possibly wouldn't be exposed to it. But if I'm sort of talking at EFFC level a little bit at the moment, one of the big projects that we're doing there at the moment is trying to promote the message across the whole of Europe, including UK, that, you know, we're an industry of problem solvers, and that we want to be respected as that within the supply chain. You know, rather than put the piles in the ground, you do the ground investing, put the piles in the ground, whatever it is, and oh, by the way, here's a whole load of risk that we're dumping on you, because we don't want to take it. And so I sort of feel that there's a sort of big sort of consultative aspect to what we need to do in that business development role personally.
Yeah, what I'd like to do, Natalie, is maybe take a step back when we're talking about sort of PPE and sort of what the interactions on site. But if we go sort of further back in the sequence than that, in terms of looking at your advice for our listeners for how you get those inquiries and sort of how do you follow up on those inquiries and actually give yourself the best chance of securing that contract. Talk us through the negotiation stage and then the next step, sort of on site delivery, and because that, like you say, is an important part of marketing and even after sales. Maybe if you could do it sequentially, it'd be really cool. So I suppose start for me from sort of getting that inquiry in the first place, because they don't always just land on your lap, do they?
No, they don't. They don't just land. So you have to be proactive. You have to go and find them. You have to make them come in. They're not just going to land. So there's direct and indirect marketing. So direct marketing, you'd be looking at advertising. You'd be looking at making sure that you're attending industry webinars and things like that. You're going and visiting clients in their offices who you know are going to be procuring frameworks or major projects. You need to be in front of them. So that comes, you need to do your homework. You need to look at where the government is planning to spend money, whether it's on the nuclear sector or infrastructure, the water utility sector. You need to find these big projects that the government's going to be investing in.
And where would you go about find, is there effectively a register of where the sort of major projects are, and then how do you get from knowing, right, there's a new, I mean, we'll all know about this, but like the new Sizewell project, that's big news, but there might be other significant projects around. How do you go from knowing that project's got planning permission to knowing where to reach out to people to actually get on a list where you might get an inquiry?
Yeah, so the internet's a great place to start. Look at the government's white papers, their bills, and also the government, every new change of government will set out a manifesto of where they're going to invest and spend money. So you need to start there. And then off the back of the government spend will be the private sector, looking at who's rich and who's going to be investing and in what areas. And then getting into those, go right in at the top, and then you need to find out from them who the decision makers are going to be, so whether it's the tier one contractors, whether it's going to be the consultant designers, and find out the procurement route as well.
Yeah, because there's a subcontractor, as we've both been, there's no point in us, for instance, going straight to HS2, for want of somebody else, and as the main client, and saying, can you give us a pilot inquiry? That chance that's going to be filtered down through main contractors, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you'd have to get the list of the main contractors and then try and get the inquiry.
The list of main contractors will be published. So any public sector framework agreement, and there's framework agreements for the likes of HS2, national highways, things like that. So you'd need to look into that, do your homework. There's usually six tier one contractors appointed, whether it's Balfour Beatty's, Mace, Morrison, whoever. And then you need to go into their procurement departments. You need to become an approved supplier. And then once an approved supplier status, get in and try and meet with the decision makers who are working on that particular project, because they will put you forward when the work has been procured. They'll put you, yeah. They'll put your name forward to be on the shortlist of tenderers.
That term framework, you do occasionally hear that referred to by site investigation companies and the ground engineering contractors. Can you explain what that means and sort of how commonplace it is that you might be able to get a framework agreement? Are you literally talking, I don't know, let's say within the water sector, you've got an agreement with Thames Water, go back to your site investigation days, that any borehole to 20 metres will cost £5,000, just for, you know, just to give an example. Is that the way it works, or is that far too simplistic? Are we more talking about being an approved supplier when we talk about frameworks?
So you need to be an approved supplier, first of all, and then under a framework, you'd have to bid. It would be under competitive tendering to become a framework supplier, where it'll be for 3 years usually, with two further years optional. Major frameworks have been let, which have been 10 years in the past, with the Coal Authority and United Utilities. I think they were 5 plus 5 plus 2. So 12 years in total. So to be on those frameworks is really, really important for any subcontractor within the ground investigation or piling sector, because it's a work stream with a much reduced competition, if you like. And usually under a framework, you'll agree a set of rates that will stand for a year, and then there's an annual uplift or an opportunity to review the rates annually.
Because that must be really difficult, you know. I think the same applies for piling and ground investigation. If you've got a really challenging ground, or you've got a really tight access job, the rates there that you'd want will be completely different to the rates on a nice, easy sort of clay soils, open site, much space as you want. So that do these frameworks provide enough flexibility for situations where the conditions become more challenging?
Yes, so there'll be set rates for drilling 0 to 10, 10 to 20 metres, 20 to 30 metres, set rates for doing SPTs and in situ testing, that kind of thing. But there'll be a variance will be on mobilisation costs, welfare costs, if you're working on slopes, if you're working in difficult accesses, and that's where the money can vary. And you would do a mini bid, if you like. A mini bid scenario where you use your framework rates, and then anything that's a variable, such as the location, the topography, where you're working, if you're working in a confined space, anything that's a little bit different, that's where the variables come in, and you would price that specifically for the job.
How do you compete in a framework agreement? Is it that on those, they will have you in mind for a sort of category of job, and all of those jobs go to you as their sort of preferred supplier? Or is it that you've got to compete against, you know, a number of other suppliers who also are on the framework agreement for those jobs? And if so, How do you do that? How do you differentiate yourself from the competition in those situations?
Usually in the first instance, the first year of a framework, it's on a rotation basis. So everybody that has got onto the framework, there's sometimes six of you, sometimes three, but a much reduced supply list. It will go on rotation for the small projects, and usually it's kind of divvied up quite fairly so that everybody gets roughly the same value from the framework. And then for large projects where the customer, so whoever is holding the framework, they're looking for greatest value. So for major projects, you would bid within the framework against the other suppliers on that framework. And that happens on, you know, utilities, framework agreements, national highways. You would bid for those particular projects that are major, just so that the client gets best value, but also not just in terms of price, but also the best approach and methodology, because you have to put together a full kind of approach methodology. How are you going to do the project? How are you going to reduce the program? How are you going to reduce and manage risk? And also having things like a local supply chain. It all depends on, excuse me, your proposed program of works, if you can fit it in line with the client's optimum program as well. So there's lots of things that would lead to the award under a framework agreement, and it usually comes down to your proposal and then cost.
Yeah, so sort of being really well aligned and then cheaper than the next mic guy, I guess.
So you've put your bid in, whether it be a framework or a sort of more conventional tender. You've sold it to them by pointing out the way you differentiate yourself. We've already spoken about on site in terms of reputation and sort of making sure you're doing the right things, that everybody is playing their role in selling the business. What about the sort of after sale side of it? How big is that for you, and sort of follow up for the next opportunity, whether it be another inquiry, and what sort of role does entertainment because it's something that's been big in the construction industry for years and years, corporate entertainment. I'd be interested to know if you see that much and what place it's got.
Well, I don't really go in for all the corporate stuff because I just find it quite awkward, really. Yeah. So if we go back to the kind of like when you're tendering, if you're tendering a really major project, you put your tender together and you put your proposal together. If there's an opportunity to then present your proposal, then that's where the decision can be made. That's where you can absolutely do it. And with things changing as they are, there's usually an option to present in person or present on Teams. And in my opinion, you need to go and do it in person, and then you need to look into the eyes of who you're selling to, and you need to persuade them that you are absolutely the best company to do and deliver their project. And you can't do that over Teams. It's impossible, because you need to get to know them, and you want them to like you as well. And you can't really judge that when you're on Teams or on a screen. But when you're in front of people, the key thing to remember is people like them. So if you've understood the brief completely and you're able to convey to them that you're the best person to do that project, you will win. You will, and it's not always on the cheapest price. You will win it. And then when you've won that project, it's really important to, you know, your teams are on site, all the guys are on site delivering the project. It's really important to go back and go on to site and say, this is how we said we were going to do it, that's what we have to do, and make sure that they're doing what you proposed to do in your bid. So you have to do what you said you're going to do, what you promised, you've got to deliver. And and then that way you get to know the site team from the client side, the investigation supervisor, the consultant engineer that's on board, and then you start developing those relationships. And the next time any one of those needs a ground investigation or a piling project or anything, they're going to remember you and they're going to ring you up and go, I've got this job. Do you want the opportunity?
I'm sure they'll
to
remember
be?
You, Natalie.
Yes.
I couldn't help, though, but reflect on your comment that people like them, which I think it's a truism, but it's a little bit depressing to think there's not that scope for individuality and diversity.
I think you've slightly misinterpreted that. So okay. When I say people like them, I mean they're in the job they're in because they're really enthusiastic and passionate about ground engineering. And if you can get in front of them and also convey your own passion and enthusiasm for ground engineering and the project that they're trying to deliver, that will help you to win the job.
Yeah, we talk about this in the mentoring program, how important that is, that sort of the mirror. It's sort of mirroring to a degree, but actually it's finding those points of connection, and those are actually very much not connected so much to what I guess we'd call protected characteristics these days, or things that we understand as diversity, in my view. And they sort of transcend those things. And actually, you can have situations where those passions are actually crossing those differences and connecting across those differences really positively in my experience. Which is lovely. And when that happens, it's amazing. I love it. It's a great thing.
Yeah. It's amazing, really, how much we've got in common with so many people. I was listening to a radio show the other day. I can't remember exactly which channel or who was on it, but they had this feature whereby a guest, like a caller, would phone up, and they'd be from Wales, and the presenter was from Wales, and they would have, I think it was 2 minutes to find somebody that they both knew. So, like, there was no, like, immediate connection obvious, but, like, they would just talk through, oh, have you been to here and here? And, like, there was, even within 2 minutes, there was, like, a 50% success rate with this feature of them being able to find an individual. And that's just knowing the same person. So when we're talking about knowing, having similar interests, you know, I think there is so much shared ground, and obviously the industry you're in is a good one. I mean, I always followed tons of sports, and I love sport anyway, but there is a clear benefit because so many people in construction love sport, and you can find common ground, and it sort of breaks the ice. You'll find a lot of the time, you know, if you mention a football team that you follow, you'll see somebody a couple of years down the line, and they'll say, oh, how are they getting on this season? And it's amazing what sticks in people's minds. You do wonder sometimes whether people are like keeping a database of this stuff and really, are sharp on it. I know, some of the past presidents and prime ministers, they've always been good at engaging with people at events and sort of a prep to say, oh, I think I met you at such and such event, and how's so and so, and you know, there's a lot of diligence and support that's provided to create that positive environment for communication.
Oh, definitely. I think the classic on that was the London Olympic bid, where there were dossiers on each of the IOC members, International Olympic Committee members, and people like David Beckham were being briefed on what each individual was sort of into, and so that when they were having those conversations, they were able to sort of slip into that. I mean, that's almost I wouldn't say that was nefarious, but it's certainly very, very smart way of doing it. I think it's it always works better if it comes from the heart, though.
Absolutely. But I think it can be both, can't it?
It can. Yeah.
You know, if you can be prepared, you can know stuff about people, and you can still be genuine in asking those questions and really be interested in in the answers.
Yeah, my sort of best one on that, I think, in the part of my previous career in the world of marketing was being out for dinner actually with a client and bonding with him over a shared love of Led Zeppelin. He was a bit older than me, but I had sort of picked up on Zeppelin when I was a teenager, and I was actually rediscovering at that moment some of their original recordings, and because it was sort of a little bit in the back of my mind, I just had an instinct that he would be into that, and it was his favourite band. It was
amazing.
It was one of those.
I've been to lots of tender interviews, and if you ever walk into a tender interview and there's a panel of interviewers and you've worked with one of them previously on a site from 10, 15, 20 years ago, straight away you remember, and they remember you, and you know straight away you've got that affinity, and they know that they can trust you. And what you're going to say is going to come from the heart, from experience. Yeah. And it's about, you know, having that connection. And you can't buy that. You can, it's just from experience, from life, and having worn your boots and been on site. And, you know, everybody's career progresses. And it's really nice because we've got a really small industry. When you do see people from, you know, past projects, yeah, past sites, and you go, oh, that one went really well, didn't it? Oh, do you remember when that happened or this happened? And, you know, and there's always, you know, funny stories of sites and God knows what.
It all happens.
Don't you find that connection when you're not, that's a lot stronger if you've had an in-person meeting?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah,
because I think we're doing this on electronically, and we're having a good time, you know, great conversation. But I think connections are stronger when you at least spend some physical time in the same environment.
Yeah, and when we're working on projects, you know, the site team have to work together, from the subcontractor, the main contractor, the site investigation supervisor, we're all on that same team and we all have that one common goal. And I think it's, you know, you work together so closely, and because we work remotely as well, you know, people are living away from their homes, their wives, their partners, their children, their families. And it's really important that you have that real connection with the whole of the site to deliver the whole of the project together. And that starts almost at the tender stage, where you can really convince that whoever's making the decision, you know, we really understand what you want out of this. We're not here to just deliver a project and drill some boreholes or put some piles in. We're here to help you deliver the whole of the project, even though we're just doing a little part of it. And being face to face with them and having that connection for the good of the delivery of the whole of the project, I think matters an awful lot. And that's where the sales side comes in. But it's not like hard sell. It's just being passionate and caring about what you're doing.
Because after your focus on sort of marketing and business development, you actually progressed, and we mentioned at the outset you're managing director of Skellair, but you really rose to prominence through your being managing director at Concept. And there's actually a saying that I've come across before, you might be aware of it, that marketing is too important to be left to the marketing people. And I think, you know, as the managing director, no offence to marketing people listening, but as managing director, you are like front foremost the salesperson, aren't you, for a business? So I think it's a great sort of angle to come in from. But how did you embrace those those new challenges of being a managing director, and what did you find what most difficult when you took it on, and most exciting?
Well, mostly exciting. The key thing that I've learnt about being an MD, if you like, being a managing director, it's to empower all of your staff and really make them feel valued. I usually restructure quite heavily after a period of time. So get to know all of the staff, get to know their skills, get to know what makes them happy, what makes them, you know, get out of bed in the morning and really drive and enthusiastic, and play to their strengths, find what's really good for them, and what drives them, what motivates them, and then make sure that their position in the company reflects that, so that they can be the very best of themselves. So restructure everything. But the one thing that I've taken with me from marketing is you actually need to do internal marketing as much as you do external marketing. So you need to do marketing within the business so that everybody is on the same page and everybody wants the very best for the company. Everybody's going in the same direction. Everybody knows where the business is going to go. So I don't have, you know, any secrets. I don't say, well, this is the plan, and then only tell a few people. If there's a business plan, it'll be rolled out to the entire company, and everybody will be at the same briefing. So this is the plan. This is how we're going to do it. And everybody plays a key role in the success, because true success of any business is shared success. Everybody contributes to it. And so there's that marketing, if you like. It's just getting everybody on board, so that we're all going together.
Yeah, I'm interested when you're talking there about restructuring. It sounded to me, and please correct my assumption if I'm wrong, that you felt that was a necessary process of evolution, almost regardless of how things were going, just to freshen things up. Is that correct?
Sometimes you need to freshen things up a little bit to re-energise, to put new life into something. And I did, at Concept, I'd inherited an amazing team, and, you know, from the founding members, Anastasia and Milan, and they'd done an amazing job of building that from nothing up to, you know, a £12 million turnover business with 112 staff at one point. So I inherited that, but to get it to where it needed to be, we had to put in a pre-construct department, because there wasn't a pre-construction department. We had to change things around a little bit so that everybody had a clearly defined role and expectation of their role, and they knew what was expected of them. And on a almost daily basis, you know, this is the expectation of that particular role. And finding the right person for each role, particularly in the pre-construction team and also major projects teams as well. And playing to everybody's strengths. And that's how that business grew to the size that it did and took on the kind of projects, the complexities of projects that they undertake in London was through building the right teams, all the way from the ground workers all the way up to, you know, the chief estimator. Everybody played a part in that.
And what role did analysis of performance play in the use of data? It sounds like you're keeping a really close eye on how individuals were performing. And I wondered what sort of metrics you would look at and how you reacted maybe to those situations.
They're not really clearly defined, you know, like this is an expectation. I think I've not really put that across very well. So in terms of obviously always annual reviews and things like that, but more a case of, you know, my door's always open and come and have a chat with me. But whenever I went to a site or I went to a different office, whichever office I was in, I always go and start in the warehouse, go and have a chat with everybody, go into the laboratories, have a chat with all of the team there, find out if everything's okay with them, what's causing them any issues, what's causing them trouble, what's making them happy. Just speaking to all the staff. It's about communication. It's not about weekly targets and checks. If they're happy, the environment in which they're working is safe and everything is aligned to the goals of the business. It's about communication, about speaking to your staff and listening to them and being part of the team.
Yeah.
It's not a them and us kind of thing, you know. Mm. I'm more than happy to put my boots on and go trail pitting. More than happy to do that, actually.
See, you don't employ a strategy of a decimation like the Romans. Just say, take 1 in 10 out a year.
Absolutely.
I've worked with organisations in the financial services sector who have that policy of cutting the lowest performing people within their business year on year, and they think it drives performance, whereas actually those are horrible places to work, I think. Really, really callous kind of corporate culture sort of persisting in those spaces, I think. So I'm more a fan of what you advocate.
If somebody is performing poorly, there's usually a reason behind it. You know, that person's been employed because they were at some point suitable for the role. And then if they're suddenly not performing, there has to be a reason for it, whether it's because they're no longer happy at work, perhaps they don't feel they're paid enough, perhaps they don't feel that their remuneration is quite right. And if that's the case, you need to have a conversation and say, it is what it is. And if the person thinks that they can earn more money by going elsewhere, then let them go elsewhere and earn that money. If it's because they've got a personal issue, something's not quite right, and then they need support. And then you need to, you know, offer that support for them so that they can become well again. It might be that they've got mental health issues, they've got personal issues, that it might be relationship issues, or anything outside of work. But you need to provide a safe space at work and offer support where it's needed, because that person will be brilliant again, and they just need support for a small period of time. So you need to invest in your staff. I think that's absolutely key.
Yeah.
You know, I've worked for quite big corporate companies, and some of them get it right, some of them don't. And the worry...
Well, I think from one of our previous discussions, you thought that there was a bit of a shift within the industry, particularly with the introduction of private equity into construction, and that perhaps the business cultures where the company is PE led are more akin to what Kieran was referring to.
Absolutely. So the geotechnical industry, particularly in the UK, it's really small, and the majority of companies have started, you know, privately, and they're mostly privately owned, and they're small little businesses with really enthusiastic engineers or geologists or drillers who just love the industry. And then, you know, they get sold and they get bought by private equity finance businesses and companies who, you know, we all have to earn money. That's why we go to work. We go to work to earn money. But the private equity finance groups, if you like, they're absolutely ruthless. And they'll come in, they need results quick. And results don't happen very quickly in the geotechnical business industry, because there's such a big gestation period of projects. It can sometimes be 18 months from opportunity to actual award of project. And then you've got to deliver the project, which might be, you know, 19, 20 weeks on site. Then you've got, if there's a claim or anything else, so your money's years down the line. And equity, private equity, they don't have time for that. So they need immediate results, because they have to turn it to profit.
Yeah, it's typically a 5-year plan, isn't it?
Yes.
Build it up and flip it, as in sell it on again at a higher
So it's
number.
Acquisition, build it, make it as profitable as possible and then flip it and sell it. And to make things profitable, it's headcount. They call it efficiencies, but it's not. It's headcount reduction, and people are let go. And the people that are left have to work harder and harder and harder for the same amount of remuneration, the same money, but they're working harder and harder. And I think that takes the life and soul out of a company. It strips away the happiness and the joy of going to work because you're literally being flogged.
It strips value very quickly, doesn't it? You can cut 20% of cost out of a business all day long, every day, very easily if you want to, but that doesn't mean that you will have a valuable or something that creates value at the end of that process. At all. In fact, you're much more likely not to.
In this industry as well, it's really dangerous because you're making people work much harder, but you're also devaluing the end product because at some point corners will be cut. And when corners are cut, accidents happen. But also there's a decrease in quality because people are rushing. So the quality of your product is decreasing, and that will affect your reputation and your ability to win another project. But, you know, private equity, they'll go, if you don't win another project in 3 years' time, it doesn't matter because we'll have flipped you and we don't really care. The other damaging thing that private equity is doing is the lack of investment into staff. So they're not investing in staff training, they don't invest in CPD, they don't invest in innovation, research, development. So they're actually dumbing down the industry because usually these are the companies that would be leading and innovating and looking at evolving techniques to be safer, to gather greater information, to increase the quality of what we do. But there's no money put back into any of the businesses. So our industry's becoming a little bit dumbed down, if you like.
I think it's an even bigger problem, Natalie, based on the conversations that we see within Build UK, where it used to be, certainly pre-pandemic, the chair of Build UK at the time, his favourite sort of statistic was that the top 10 main contractors had an average margin of minus 0.1% or something, maybe 0.2%, something of that order. So they're all losing money through operating in the industry, and therefore they were having to recover their costs from the supply chain and squeezing the supply chain, which creates this sort of negative spiral. And it all actually, I mean, when you look at retention, the problem of retention in the construction industry generally, thankfully not one that we have so much in piling for historic reasons, but everywhere else it's a big problem. It all stems from the fact that there's a lack of capital in the industry at the top coming into the projects in the first place. And I think what you're talking about is also a sort of symptom of that same problem of kind of trying to take money out, trying to maximize profitability in the short term and then take money out. And actually, this is the sector that needs more investment probably than ever before, but done in the right ways, and actually appreciating the value that exists at every level. And what's being brought. So it's a difficult. I think UK construction is a very difficult place in our current moment, and I think has been actually for the last 10, 15 years.
Yeah, probably. I completely agree. It's the sector that needs investment, not just having all of the profit stripped out of it. We're already in a really difficult position because there's such a massive skills gap. There's a lack of people wanting to come into the construction industry. There's even fewer wanting to come into the geotechnical or the ground engineering industry because sometimes they don't know about it. But also it's got a bad press, it's got a bad rap. And for me, my opinion, only my opinion, private equity isn't helping at all. They're not helping the construction industry, or certainly not the ground engineering or geotechnical industry. At all. they are making it a place where people don't want to work.
Well, it's it sends you into a bit of a downward spiral. The more private equity companies that are out there that are really keen on growth, you know, there's only so much work that is really available anyway.
Yeah.
But we can't always, all of us, continue to grow, can we?
No.
And so it puts a lot of pressure on people and on margins. You know, you go out there and buy more machines. Well, you've got to keep those machines busy. How do you keep them busy? Well, you drop the price. And I think there does ultimately need to be more consolidation in the market, and in order for businesses to return to a greater level of profitability.
I agree. So, the private equity, they'll group lots of small businesses together, five or six businesses together, and then they'll strip out all of the overlapped positions within those companies and get it as lean as possible, you know, to get the revenue and the margins up. They need to do more and more work, and that's where you end up almost buying projects and then getting into a claims culture to claw back any profit. And it's really awful to see that's happening within the industry, because it's precluding small enterprises that are enthusiastic, that do have that drive and that passion, and they just want to break into the industry. It's making it more difficult for them. They won't have the money to spend on innovation, technical advances, and then the private equity companies, they don't want to spend on that either. So the industry is kind of stagnant, and we're struggling a little bit. But our ultimate clients, particularly in the private public sector, they're looking for innovation. They're looking for, you know, the next best thing that can deliver their project with efficiency, with greater quality and technical advancement. But there's no money in it to develop that technology.
Yeah, and to bring people in, and you touched on recruitment or training challenges. The numbers of geology students certainly has reduced over the years. How difficult has it been as a managing director of a site investigation business to find graduates? Can you give us sort of examples of how long it's taken to find people, or and what maybe the impact has been on sort of wage inflation?
It's tough. It's really tough. I think that at the moment there's only, I think it's 21 or 22 universities that actually run a geotechnical or ground engineering course. You know, that's tricky in itself. And then people don't realise, young adults, they don't realise that geology is a thing as well. So we need to get into schools and colleges and explain that geology is a massive thing. And it's, it's the basis of all construction. You need to understand the geology before you can start building or constructing anything. And I'd like to see, you know, geology, particularly applied geology, playing a greater part of any civil engineering course, because you're not speaking about yourself, Steve, you've already said you're a civil engineer, but in my experience, civil engineers just think that geologists are, you know, pain of their lives, and you know, but it's the geologists.
Well, that's certainly not my view, but I suppose I've always been more interested as a sort of a geotechnical leaning civil engineer in soils, and I would actually have loved to have seen more geology on my course. There was a space for it, and we did some field trips, but my knowledge in that field isn't as good as it should be. Actually, I don't know if you, Kieran, you follow Louisa on on Instagram or some other. So Louisa Hendry is a guest that we've
the previously Scottish had on the
podcast.
Yeah.
There you go.
There you go.
Her Scottish reputation is widespread in the industry. And I noticed that she was actually doing trips to Scottish islands and doing geology tours, which sounds really cool, actually. I'm thinking of signing up myself. And
you should definitely shout out to Louisa. She's just had a baby, actually, so congratulations. Oh, yeah. Louisa, but she was out in the field. She posted a video to Instagram a couple of days ago, I think, where show just before she had her baby, being helped over a stile at basically 9 months pregnant. still out there looking at rocks, so
excellent.
great advocate for our industry.
She really is. And we need more women in the industry, actually, because I'm pretty certain that, you know, there is this massive skills gap, but also we need to encourage more women into the industry, because I'm absolutely certain that women can help fill that skills gap. Everyone talks about, oh, we've got a massive skills gap, there's not enough this, there's not enough geologists. But yeah, hang on, you know, we encourage the women to go into that industry and make it easier for women to work within the industry as well. And the skills gap will close.
Yeah.
Have you seen positive change, Natalie, during the course of your career in terms of support for women and their career progression?
Yes, there has been positive change, but not nearly enough, and it's really slow as well. So you know, when I started, it was early 90s, 1992, I think, and it was unusual to have a woman on site. And, you know, there's been lots of advances, mostly through legislation and CDM and things like that. But, you know, back then, 30-something years ago, I'd go onto site and there wouldn't even be a separate toilet. Mm. And that would be tricky, because you don't want to share a toilet with all the drillers and things like that. And sometimes there'd be no facilities at all. And that was just really disappointing, but it changed. Unfortunately, I worked for Soil Engineering, and they were really good. And you know, there was very few times where I was disappointed with a lack of facilities. But there are companies still that have projects and they don't have facilities for women. We're still seeing right now difficulties with PPE, where you're just expected to wear men's PPE, cut of PPE. I can remember when I first started at Soil Engineering, we had trouble getting some safety boots, some steel toe cap boots, because I take a size 4, and in the end they had to have them made. They just didn't do them in small sizes. They did little shoes that would be worn in you know, food factories and things like that, that came in a size 3, size 4, but not a boot that was suitable for site works. So I think I ended up having them made. I think I've still got them. So they were very well made by Dr. Excellent. Martin. So there are advances. I mean, you can buy the right size shoes and safety boots and safety PPE and everything else. But there needs to be an acknowledgement that when women are on site, it's not like, oh, we've got to, you know, watch our P's and Q's and not swear and this, that and the other. It's not about that. It's about treating everybody equally as a human being, and also being really honest when you're tendering. Because if you tender for a project, you have to make allowances and you have to make sure that there's adequate provision of welfare, and it costs, and I understand that it costs. But if you've got a big site, you're going to have multiple welfare facilities, so it makes no difference if they're men or women's. But you know, back in the day, there'd be one portaloo, and I wasn't going to use it.
Yeah. You know. Well, I think conditions, they have improved, and I think part of part of the challenge that we've had is there's not been the role models in senior positions, and obviously one of few exceptions to that, there are other prominent female leaders within the industry, and I think it's great the initiative that Grand Engineering Magazine have had in terms of the, I think they call it the 20 20 key women in industry. Sorry, apologies to Nir and the team for not remembering exactly how it's referred to. But once a year, there's a profile piece on 20 women within the industry. It might have well have been one of those, Natalie, in the past.
Well, I've been nominated, but I've never sent in my profile or my photograph, because whilst I'm very flattered that people have nominated me as one of the top 20 leaders of women in construction, I don't want to be recognised as a woman in
construction. You don't want to be defined by that.
Just want to be recognised for my presence in the industry, regardless of whether I'm a woman or not.
Yeah, I do respect that viewpoint. I'm sure it's held by a lot of people, but I think there is a benefit from visibility, and you know, we used to sort of go into rooms at these big industry events, and there wouldn't be really any women at the events at all, and part of that is because the few that do come feel really intimidated. Being in very small as a percentage of the group, and it's sort of I know Kira and I, we've been really trying to positively change that by getting companies to bring along women to the events. So
the FPS Awards has really, really improved in that space. It's still
hugely,
still way to go, but it. But it's change. There's a palpable change to the energy in the room when in a big event. You know, we have something like 250 people at the FPS Awards, and actually, when it's a much more gender balanced event, the energy in the room is so much more positive, I think, than when it's sort of male dominated. Where I've been not at FPS, but in a previous life, I was at. A sort of business awards for entrepreneurs, and it felt toxic being in that space. I have to say that
there's very alpha
massively, because you know, because the people weren't listening to anybody. You know, I remember the guy who was presenting the awards was struggling to keep control of the room because nobody was really interested unless they were going up and getting theirs. Compared to, say, something like the First Women Awards, shout out to the First Women Awards, where the energy there was, which is, you know, sort of almost completely a female, was respectful, positive, uplifting, you know, was an absolute pleasure to be part of. And that had, the one I went to with that had Claire Balding presenting, and she is... Okay. You know, A1 for that
for that sort of thing.
She is absolutely brilliant. But I think everybody gains from having a properly representative industry, and I'm glad that we're doing something about it through the mentoring scheme in the Ground Forum mentoring scheme. But still on site, I think it's a challenge. We collected some data a few years back for FPS, and I think it was 99.9% male on site. It was more sort of 60-40, 55-45, I think, for women
for the office.
Men. In the office, but on site it was all men, basically.
And I think that's a really good valid point, Kieran, because when we're tendering for work and when we're submitting all of our statistics and things like that, you have to say how diverse your workforce are and where, you know, how many women you have working in the industry, in your business, what positions, and you know where you are on the gender pay gap, if you like. And I'd like to see that split of on-site women and women that are office-based. I'd like to see it split, because I think you're absolutely right. The women in the industry that actually go on site will be less than 1%. and companies are, you know, reporting, oh, we've got 30% women in the construction industry or in our business. But of those 30% of women, or whatever percentage it is, how many of them actually put PPE on? How many of them actually get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and they're on site for 7 o'clock having, you know, their daily briefing, their DABs, their start of shift briefing, and then go out and work 8 hours and then hand over? Or how many of those women, how many of those staff are women that go into the industry, that go onto a live railway embankment and work a night shift? Or, you know, what's the actual truth of it? Or are they including all of the women that are actually in office roles, that are HR, that are receptionists, that are, you know, marketing, but marketing as in the looking after their social media, posting things that they've not had direct involvement in? So, you know, I think if when it comes down to the truth, I'd really like to see those figures reported for actual women on site in construction in an engineering role.
Doing delivery.
Yeah. And then we'll get to the bottom of it, because there's big companies that, you know, deliberately don't employ women because it will impact on their site programs, because it will impact on their profitability, because, you know, women do have children, we do get pregnant, we do have families, we do need some time off. I personally only had 2 weeks off, 6 weeks off for each of my children, but that was my choice because I knew if I had any longer off, I wouldn't be able to come back into the industry because it moved quite fast. And I would have never been able to progress to where I have today had I taken any maternity leave greater than 6 weeks.
I think that needs looking at through the lens of equality of expectation. So actually, you need to accommodate working parents, and men should be being expected to be, you know, those roles, those traditional caregiving roles, shouldn't just be. Put to women, I think,
exactly.
in my you know, I'm quite woke though, so
if we address this issue for women, it's going to help a lot of men as well. Men are obviously parents, want to support their children and want to spend time with their children at school events and after school do the pickups. You know, it's not exclusive to women.
It's not exclusive to women, but within our industry, parenting is quite difficult because you do have to work away from home. You do have to spend long periods away, Monday to Friday, sometimes weekends as well. You're working shifts and, you know, getting to those school events, doing the school drop-off is a luxury. Getting to parents' evening, all of those things. I've got two daughters and their father never, ever managed to get to a single parents' evening because of his job. He worked in the industry as well. And that, luckily, I had an employer who was very flexible and I could manage my day, but I was in a role, a business development role, so it wasn't tied to site hours anymore. So I could manage to juggle family and work and keep my career on track. But, you know, there needs to be more appreciation of what it means for a woman to go onto site. So, Kieran, you spoke about having a more kind of like levelled presence, bringing a different kind of vibe to an environment. And I think having women on site and having a more balanced site team of male and female, men and women, I think it does promote a different kind of culture on site. And I think it's a positive culture as well.
I think we can all agree on that. I think if we could probably have a whole new podcast, and I think it'd be a really great forum for getting people involved and discussing ideas to improve gender diversity, specifically on site. You know, yes, the whole industry, but I think specifically on site, and talk through ideas to really address that. But I think for today, we'll say thank you very much, Natalie, for your time, and also Kieran. Really enjoyed our chat today. Hope you have too, and I'm sure we'll be back in touch soon with another episode.
Thank you.